From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Why is it that if an ordinary legislator gets his own committee that he uses to make contributions, we do think that's potentially corruption, but when the legislator is one of the leaders, we don't think there's any corruption at all, and they could spend unlimited amounts. It doesn't make any sense.
Despite a year of headlines about a state budget impasse that has significantly reduced state support, students are flocking to our universities in record numbers.
The administrative law judge would make a recommended decision in order. She'll hold a full-fledged administrative hearing. The parties would be able to call witnesses. But yes, she would issue a recommended decision, actually reaching the merits of the allegations.
That's Melissa Malinsky. She's an Illinois State Labor Relations Board director, speaking about the process that the board's been going through regarding AFSCME and an impasse with the Rauner administration. We'll talk more about that. Also, U of I President Tim Killeen, he says enrollment is up at the University of Illinois. And also, Jacob Hubert, he's with the Illinois Justice Center, which says it will appeal a judge's ruling on campaign limits. We're going to talk more about those issues and more today on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Also with us today, Jamie Dunn, our Illinois Issues Editor. And our guest today is Ivan Marino. He's with the Associated Press. Ivan, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for inviting me.
Amanda, I'm going to turn to you to start. There had been rumors floating for several months that AFSCME might be headed toward a strike, especially around the first part of September, and most of that discussion was coming from the Rauner administration. Well, there's been no strike so far, still no contract. An administrative law judge has weighed in. Where do things stand?
No strike, and in fact, AFSCME says that that says something about the Rauner administration's credibility, or really lack thereof, and says that they hope that this kind of destroys any of that thought, and wonder if the administration was just trying to foment some angst among the ranks of state employees. Where things stand now for most employees is really as it was before, and that is they're still operating under the former contract, the one that's been out of date now for well over a year and a half. And that is what they're operating under, but uncertainty about what the future holds. Uncertainty, I guess, also for taxpayers in the state. If you take Rauner and his allies at their word that what AFSCME is asking for is going to cost taxpayers more money. So that's where things stand. You do have this administrative law judge gave her opinion, and it did come out last week, but it was after this show taped, and also I think everybody was still really combing through it because it was a 200-something page opinion with another 200-plus pages of addendums and such, and therefore, really, in fact, her decision was one that both sides were able to say we won something, and the also able to point their finger, but it is just an advisory opinion, basically. What really now, that goes before the Illinois State Labor Relations Board. Both AFSCME and the administration will have an opportunity to send in some extra information, to, you know, kind of pad their arguments. But truly, we are waiting for a decision from the board. And we're thinking that that could come in November.
Well, let me ask this. They stopped negotiating, I believe, earlier in the spring. There is no plan to go back to negotiating at this time, and they'll probably at least wait for that decision coming up?
Yeah, that is correct. And what was interesting about, what I found interesting about the decision is that the judge kind of dinged both sides for, as she put it, that neither side had, quote, acted in a completely virtuous manner. As the negotiations have gone on for more than a year and a half. Either side has, once they stopped negotiating, has accused the other of walking away from the table. And I think the judge's decision here kind of just reinforces this fact that, again, both sides have been lobbying these accusations. And the bottom line is that the judge is advising that they go back to the bargaining table. But whether they do that or not, I guess will be remains to be seen here in the next couple of months.
Ivan, let me
back to the bargaining table, let me go back real quick. Ways. Yes.
I'm sorry, just real quick. I wanted to go back to that point that Ivan was making, that they weren't being maybe honest about their intentions.
Virtuous.
What was that? I mean, you know, AFSCME certainly wants a new contract and wants certain things, and of course the governor in his administration wants certain things. Where is that concern coming from the law judge?
You know, I think, again, still kind of combing through the big opinion, but I think that the concern comes from a whole lot of areas. I mean, clearly, if you look at the evidence that each side presented, there were accusations about, you know, swearing going on in these closed door meetings and really just kind of a contentious atmosphere. I think that it's maybe no surprise if some of that did in fact happen. We have a hard time knowing because we, of course, aren't invited in on these negotiations when they've been paused. But that's what I believe the administrative law judge is really referring to, is how very contentious these negotiations were. I think the Rauner administration points to that as evidence that they believe there is an impasse. The AFSCME trying to say, no, of course, they believe that there is not one. They say that they have been at the ready to negotiate and would welcome to get that up and running again. So, Sean, kind of to answer your question more directly in terms of what does this mean for negotiations, the administrative law judge saying there are some areas where I want you back at the bargaining table, other areas where she believes that there is a true impasse and Rauner could impose the, quote, last best offer. Again, this depends on if the board agrees with her or not. That does not actually have to happen. But they could, both sides could say, you know what? Look at this mess. We just want to get back negotiating. I don't think there has been no indication that that, in fact, is what's going to happen. I think we will more likely see this continue to stretch out until, again, at least November. So waiting for a board decision. And it could then go to court.
To Amanda's point about you know, how contentious the negotiations have been, I mean, another thing that the judge said about that was that the negotiations, quote, reflected a battle mindset on both sides of the table, end quote. So again, it kind of just gives you a flavor of just how contentious everything has been here over the last year and a half.
Charlie, they're supposed to be somewhat contentious. They both want to hold their ground and try to come together at some point. I mean, why should this be a surprise?
I think because this has gone on, what's the right way to say it? It's in a more hostile atmosphere. We've never had a governor of either party before who was so adamantly critical and opposed to the notion of public employees organizing themselves into unions. And at one point on the campaign trail, he suggested that he'd be willing to take a strike. We've never had a governor say something like that before, and we've never had this kind of acrimonious atmosphere between the labor union, AFSCME, which represents, it's the largest union representing state employees, and a governor. And I found it interesting that on the key elements of the bargaining, healthcare benefits and wages, the administrative law judge said, no, you're not at an impasse, and you ought to go back and sit down and work out a deal. And the stuff that she said there was an impasse was more or less minor things in the broader picture.
Well, let me move along, because we're going to have that issue certainly to talk about more in coming weeks. A judge this week weighing in on a campaign finance law and what some see as a loophole. A lawsuit was rejected. I'll throw this down to our folks at the Capitol and somebody there break this down for us. What law are we talking about and what problem do some people have with it?
So this is when, remember, after Rod Blagojevich in Illinois was on this tear of ethical reform, one of them was the moving from the Wild West of campaign fundraising to setting limits. And a big deal at that time was where limits were not imposed, including on legislative leaders' campaign committees during the general election. They are also limited during a primary where they, you know, would influence one party or the other, but not during the general election. And in fact, you had this lawsuit that actually stems back to 2012. So before Governor Bruce Rauner had thrown his hat in the ring when he was just mulling a run for governor. And it is a lawsuit that was filed by State Senator Kyle McCarter, also a fundraiser, I believe, and also then really primarily the attorneys for this. It's the Liberty Justice Center, which I have described as an arm of the Illinois Policy Institute, which kind of has its conservative, well-funded fingers and a whole lot of things in state government these days. And what the case really came to settle on, because the judge had knocked out many of the other arguments, there was a trial on these legislative leaders. And if, in fact, this kind of favoritism for them that isn't given to other individuals or to PACs or to other politicians, why that is, and if that was illegal, the Liberty Justice Center arguing that if you have campaign contributions because you're trying to eliminate the risk for corruption, well, there's a great risk there. The judge really tossing out that argument. But the Liberty Justice Center says it is going to appeal. And so we may not see the last of this. Clearly, the IPI and the Liberty Justice Center have a lot of money to go to court as often as they want.
Well, and when the campaign finance reform proposals were floating around after former Governor Rod Blagojevich was impeached, this is one of the issues that became kind of contentious. And the, you know, good government reform folks pointed to this as one of what they saw, one of the biggest loopholes, the fact that the parties and the leaders could spend, you know, not have limits, that it would be the biggest loophole for funneling cash. And they weren't thrilled with it, although they did not make any argument that it would be illegal.
Yeah, and it strikes me that there is a big difference between a legislative leader supporting members of his party running for seats in the General Assembly, be they Republican or Democrat, and someone who is not a legislative leader trying to get influence through contributions to an individual candidate or to the leader's PAC. And as a matter of fact, there are limits on what money can be given by private individuals to the leaders themselves. But the leader's job is to go out and elect their members. That goes with the territory. So I don't think there's any big problem there.
Yeah, and that was sort of the rationale behind this ruling, was that the leaders are an extension of the party. And if the party doesn't have these limits, you know, the leaders shouldn't either, because they are just an extension of the party.
And in another sense, it's kind of arguing over something that's not really that material anymore in the wake of the Citizens United ruling, where you can have all this dark money flowing in. And so we finally have campaign contribution limits, the last state in the country to enact them. But they came after Citizens United, and so all someone has to do is set up kind of a secret organization to back a candidate or a cause or a party and not coordinate the activities with the candidate or party. And you can bring in as much money as you want, spend it however you want. You don't even have to tell anybody where it comes from.
For
in
years,
my mind, that's the big problem in campaign finance.
For years, people have talked about the concentration of power in leadership in Illinois government. This seems as though it's just another nail driving that in, that leaders become even more powerful, hold more control over their members, though, to be able to say, you know, I control so much money that can make or break you.
It does play a role in that, absolutely. But as Charlie said, with all these outside groups in the mix, that role has probably being lessened, because there are other places you can go now for large amounts of money. But yeah, it absolutely plays a role in the leadership's power, because, you know, if you're getting elected to under a certain party, you're pretty dependent on the leadership's money and their fundraising abilities.
Jamie, let me turn to another topic here that you've been following. Waiver changes for Medicaid in Illinois. Can you give us sort of an update on what's being proposed there?
Sure. So the Rauner administration is asking to spend Medicaid money on mental health programs and substance abuse-focused programs. This wouldn't make more people eligible for the Medicaid program. It would be focused on folks that are already eligible, but it would give them flexibility on how they spend that money. So it's sort of embracing some kind of, you know, trend or newer concepts in looking at people as sort of the whole person. So not just giving you counseling or medication for your mental health, but helping you out with supportive housing and other things that help make your life more stable to help, you know, cope with some of those underlying issues. The other program that kind of stuck out to me that they would be looking at with this too is giving methadone and that kind of, you know, medical assistance to folks when they're close to getting out of prison to treat their addiction. This is something lots of states are considering trying right now. And there's actually a program at Rikers Island in New York that has been doing this for a pretty long time and that a lot of researchers point to as having really positive results for folks' health when they get out and for staying off drugs and for saving money in social services programs when people get out of prison because they've, you know, started this transition and started coping with their addiction before they get out.
Do we know if the state would get more money if this is approved from the federal government?
It wouldn't expand the amount of money that the state gets. Again, it's just more asking for flexibility to spend on things that more and more researchers and folks that are focused on these areas are saying can have really good outcomes for people. That's beyond maybe what we see as the traditional treatment that is, you know, going to a doctor or getting medication. It's about trying to spend on some of these programs that could help bring stability to people's lives.
Well, some public universities have been talking for months that they were going to see drops in enrollment this fall because of the state budget problems. Well, some have seen that and some not so much. The U of I among those. We heard from U of I President Tim Killeen at the start of the show. The Springfield and Urbana-Champaign campuses have both seen an increase this fall. So is the sky not falling for higher education because of the budget situation, or is this just something that we still have to keep an eye on?
I think very much still keep an eye on. While you heard Killeen there kind of braggadocious about the University of Illinois, that is one of the schools that has fared decently. I mean, I don't think appreciate not getting a state funding for an entire fiscal year. And yet, because of its enrollment numbers, because of its tuition, because of endowments from alumni, was able to make it through better than some other universities. So while you did see increases at both University of Illinois and also Illinois State University, some of the other universities really saw some sharp drops. And these are universities where the entire community is revolving around the school. And so you're really getting into a spiral of a downturn in the economy, at least a potential for that as you're looking at that. Namely, for example, Eastern Illinois University, that went down, I believe, about 25%. Western Illinois University down, Southern Illinois. So those are the universities that I think have really been, seeing some issues with enrollment to begin with, and then all of the consequences of MAP grants and lack of university funding and instability have surely not helped.
And Charlie, we have seen that before. I mean, SIU is an example of a school that has seen drops in enrollment for years now. The economy started to do a little better. So, I mean, that has to factor in possibly to this as well, that maybe more people are going to work rather than going to school. It can't all be laid on the state's, at the state's feet of you know, these numbers.
Well, I think a lot of it, though, is because of the uncertainty. If you're a parent, a mom or a dad, and you have a son or daughter who's a junior in high school or senior in high school, and you're looking at where to send them, and you see all this uncertainty revolving around a place like Southern or a place like Eastern or Western, and then you look and you say, hey, here's Southeast Missouri State in Cape Girardeau, and they'll give me in-state tuition, and there's no doubt that they're going to be around. And so you're looking for stability, and so that factors in it. At the University of Illinois, it's not a problem. I've used the analogy that if you have a roll of dominoes that are universities, the last domino to fall would be the U of I. The one right before it would be ISU. And both of those schools have seen enrollments increase, whereas the other schools are down substantially. And until there is some stability, because the universities went almost a full year with no state funding, and there was uncertainty about whether or not the monetary assistance grants would be available for low-income students. That kind of thing makes a family wonder, do we really want to take a chance and send our daughter or our son to somewhere that the buildings will still be around, but maybe this area of study won't be, or maybe there won't be enough faculty to offer enough classes to fit the schedule, and maybe my son or daughter is going to have to be there another semester or another year to get the coursework in. Those kind of things go through people's minds.
One of those schools that saw a drop as well was Eastern Illinois University. Jamie, you grew up over in that area, around the Charleston area. Eastern, it's had its share of problems because of this budget situation. And I read where the president now saying that they're going to have to start thinking about ways to be more self-sufficient, get away from state funding, or at least not be as reliant on state funding, let's say. Any idea what he's talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a struggle, but something that I think has been a conversation in higher education for a while now, even before this, crisis that's going on currently. We've seen state funding slowly kind of siphoned away over the last 10 years. So that is something that I think all the public universities are talking about. The most obvious source would be looking for outside money to fund research projects and that sort of thing. But of course, that's very much directed to a specific topic or a specific area of focus. So it's very difficult to find some sort of outside funding for just your general operations to, run the school and hire professors. And so that can really be a struggle. But, with Eastern, I wasn't surprised to see a pretty drastic drop. I think everyone was a little shocked at how large it was.
How large was it?
The undergrad was just over 17%, but I think, as Amanda said, the overall was higher than that. Mm-hmm. And you can't go for a year with folks questioning about whether your school is going to be able to keep its doors open. Now, the president of Eastern kept trying to reassure folks that, no, we won't be closing, but there were a lot of rumors going around. There was a lot of talk of that, and expect that, that's going to leave a mark, and it did.
Well, one of the things also announced this week, and maybe the folks uptown, I'll let you guys weigh in on this. Tim Killeen, the U of I president, he, despite all the uncertainty financially in higher education, the U of I Board of Trustees approving a $100,000 performance bonus. He's been on the job for a year now at the U of I, and he got a performance bonus for meeting certain goals. Does that send a message that that might get misconstrued a bit among some lawmakers at the Capitol who might think, hey, maybe things aren't so bad?
Sean, let me tell you that I have sat through many a higher education appropriations committee in my time during this job, and legislators ask questions about all sorts of spending, and my guess would be that they are not going to take kindly to this bonus being doled out. I do believe it was the maximum, in fact, that he could have been given for a bonus. This was something that was built into his contract. He will be eligible for similar bonuses going forward. Also, the one of the chancellors for the University of Illinois Chicago also just completing his first year and receiving a bonus. I believe that you will often hear from university administrators, including Killeen himself, that faculty recruitment, that recruitment in general has been difficult. We've read stories about professors leaving the University of Illinois because obviously Killeen would be included in this less beneficial pension benefit. Again, the instability of the state budget, a lack of raises overall. So I think, you could be given a lot of numbers that would say this is commensurate with somebody who is the CEO of a major institution and one that, as we just talked about, is faring all right despite all of this uncertainty. So that is what they would say. But yes, I'm quite sure that you are going to be probably getting some jealous looks from perhaps some of the other university presidents, and some legislators will be quite upset about that money at a time where they are trying to make an argument, and where Killeen himself is going to be faced with making an argument that the university deserves more state money at a time when the budget is just so askew.
What I would wonder, and I haven't seen the data, how does his salary compare to the salaries of the presidents of other comparable institutions,
Ten universities? I know he's lower than some of them, at least. Yeah. I can't
like
say
the University of Michigan.
Yeah, I'm pretty
Indiana,
sure he's below
Wisconsin.
Below mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it's all relative.
And
I
if
guess.
His contract is geared towards performance bonuses, that means there are certain earmarks that have to be met, and if he doesn't meet them, he doesn't get the bonus. Back in the day, it would be like a retention bonus. You'll get the money. It doesn't matter if the institution's going down the drain if you're here more than 5 years. So I think doing it based on performance is probably an improvement over the old way. And again, before I be too critical of the Board of Trustees, I'd like to see what other universities are being paid, particularly ones in the Big Ten, because those are the ones that the U of I is always compared to.
Let me go to you, Charlie, for just about a minute to go here. Phyllis Schlafly passing away this week, the conservative activist, certainly made her mark in politics. And even at the Illinois State House, you were there to cover a lot of events that she was involved with in the fight for the ERA, things like that. So give us just your remembrance of her.
She was an extremely polarizing figure. She was also very effective in organizing, I guess what you would call grassroots opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. And there were, she would have these little old ladies, these grandmotherly types, come down to the Statehouse Rotunda and hand out homemade pies to the legislature, reinforcing the notion that a woman's role should be first and foremost as a wife and mother, keeping the home fires burning, all of that traditional stuff. But I found a couple of things that were very, very contradictory in that whole ERA episode. One was that Phyllis Schlafly herself was kind of the embodiment of what a feminist would be, in the sense that she was a lawyer, she was out being a community organizer, she was an author, she was not staying at home minding the kids, you know, cooking all the meals and tending to her husband and all that, which was kind of the image that she projected that she thought women should be doing. And the other thing that struck me is very contradictory. The ERA was probably the biggest flashpoint in that era, in the 70s, in the General Assembly. It triggered protests. At one point, people chained themselves to the door of the House. There was blood spilled on the floor, not human blood, but it was kind of bizarre. There were occasions when, as an ERA vote was supposed to be coming up on the floor of the Senate or the House, someone would pull the fire alarm, and the building, the Capitol, would have to be evacuated. And so there's all this tumult. And yet, on the other hand, in the Constitutional Convention of 1970, the delegates, with not much controversy, I can't remember any controversy, included in our Illinois Constitution's Bill of Rights a article or a section that is basically the federal Equal Rights Amendment, that you can't discriminate based on sex. And that was not an issue. It was not something that was brought up at the time of the ratification of the Constitution. And so after the voters of Illinois approved putting this in our own Constitution, then suddenly this firestorm erupts over the national amendment. So I always thought that that was kind of ironic.
Phyllis Schlafly, 92 years old. She passed away. About 30 seconds left here. Ivan, let me go to you from a note from the field.
Lawmakers in their November session want to consider legislation that was inspired by the case of the Fox Lake police officer who authorities said staged his suicide last year because he feared he was going to be discovered for embezzling money from a youth program he oversaw. His wife is petitioning to get his pension benefits, but she is awaiting trial on charges related to his case. She has pleaded not guilty. While lawmakers can't do anything about her case, they want to make sure that in future cases where someone is convicted of crimes related to their deceased relative's job, that they can't access their pension benefits.
All right, that will do it for today's show. Members of our broadcast today include Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Jamie Dunn, and our guest, Ivan Marino, with the Associated Press. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.